KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, author Rick Moody joins us in the hour ahead, best known for his novels The Ice Storm and Garden State and The Diviners, and his memoir The Black Veil. He recently published a futuristic science fiction saga called The Four Fingers of Death, which is in reality three novels in one. And we'll talk with him about that new novel, as well as a range of other topics, which will include our exploring with him his passion for music and his experiences as a performing musician and his recent experiences as a somewhat older than usual father. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour, this morning's Forum program. Writer, musician, and fairly recent first-time father, Rick Moody joins us in studio for this hour. He's the author of the novels Garden State, The Ice Storm, Purple America, and The Diviners, and he also published two collections of short stories, a collection of novellas, and the Penn Martha Alburn award-winning memoir, The Black Veil. His newest novel, his fifth, is set in the year 2025, and it's called The Four Fingers of Death, and its protagonist, Montese Krasny, Randall is writing or trying to write a novelization of the remake of a 1963 classic horror film called The Crawling Arm. Rick Moody joins us in studio for the second Forum Hour, and good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks.
Well, this is, as I said to you before we went on the air, quite a departure for you from realism. This is more a dystopian, futuristic kind of a romp. It must have been fun to write, although you have some serious themes, and I want to talk about them. But there's a manned space trip to Mars. There's killer bacteria from Mars. You know, not what you expect with Rick Moody, usually.
People think it's strange when I say that the book's kind of a sequel to The Ice Storm, but it sort of is in a certain way, and I can unpack that if you're willing to tolerate some hyperbole.
I'd be interested in hearing how that's unpacked. I didn't see any keys going in bowls here or anything like suburban honk, so tell me.
Obviously, The Ice Storm had its autobiographical strains, and in the period after my parents were divorced, after the events of the ice storm, as it were, we shuttled back and forth in the suburbs from parent to parent and so on. And the one thing the three of us kids did religiously, no matter whose house we were at, was watch the Saturday night monster movies. And there were two stations in the New York area that had competing monster movies on Saturday night: Chiller Theater on the one channel and Creature Features on the other. And I think it was a way for us to kind of have some continuity.
We had Creature Features here, actually,
too. Really?
Yeah, we did.
Awesome.
So you were imbued with that or inspired by that.
Yes, with the
monster sci-fi
movie
cheesy
thing.
Stuff, yeah.
Loved those films, you know, The Creature from the Black Lagoon and Invasion of the Body Snatchers and so on.
Well, one can see that influence. There'll probably be a whole dissertation on that subject. How serious do you want us to take this, though? Because there's, you know, there's biowarfare in here, there's global warming, there's animal abuse. I mean, there's some pretty serious themes that are woven throughout this sort of romp, as I called it. And not the least of which might be secret harvesting of bacteria in space, which perhaps you might say as a novelist you wouldn't put past some of our people making policy on space. How serious do you want us to be?
Well, I think that there's a comic element to the work, to be sure. But I think that what speculative fiction does is tell us about where we are, not really about where we're going. That the futurism in science fiction is just an allegorical apparatus for us to talk about what's happening now. So all the things you just mentioned, as far as I'm concerned, could be as true of 2008 when I began the book as they are true of 2025. So insofar as it's a novel about where we are today, I think it's pretty serious.
Well, you have some things, though, that I remind of Gary Steingart's novel. We had him on recently, which is also a futuristic dystopian novel, and he's talking about people holding what's called an apparat to get your cholesterol readings and to find out your net worth. You just hold it up. You have smartphones implanted in wrists and bionic baseball players and things of this sort. I mean, these are all sort of more projecting into the future.
They're projective in that they require more technological development than we currently have. But I think from a sort of emotional, cultural standpoint, they're only mildly exaggerated.
And they're all plausible, of course.
Yeah. I mean, as William Gaddis said about JR, it doesn't have to be probable, it has to be possible.
Well, I'm reminded of Gaddis, and just the fact that you, Rick Moody, took on a novel of this sort makes me think of writers like Doris Lessing and Margaret Atwood, who have moved into that realm and feel perfectly comfortable with it. And yet there's a kind of snobbery about science fiction, too, which I'm sure you're well aware of, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, part of the effort for me was to try to thumb my nose at that snobbery a little bit, because for me, in the early 70s, when I really began reading ferociously as a kid, that work was more tolerated and more enjoyed than it is now. And I'm thinking especially of the literary examples like Kurt Vonnegut or Philip K. Dick or Richard Brautigan. Those writers were important to me, and so I wanted to try to celebrate that part of the literary family.
It's like a send-up to Vonnegut, particularly with Slaughterhouse-Five, but also with stories of his like Harrison Bergeron. And
yeah, and Sirens of Titan for me is a big book.
And there's a Pynchon influence here, too, which is pretty pronounced.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a whole section that's so much like Crying of Lot 49 that I was worried that I should venture an apology. But yes, Pynchon was big for me.
We're talking to Rick Moody. His new book is The Four Fingers of Death. Let's talk a little bit about the genesis of this. There actually is a film that this is based on.
Yeah, The Crawling Hand. It was released in 1963. It's a nearly Ed Wood-style B-film, sort of drive-in fare kind of movie.
And your protagonist, you know, people always say, where do they get names from? And this is kind of an interesting story. I think our listeners would be. There was an auction for the money to for the First Amendment
project. Yeah, indeed. And they auctioned off character names for various writers. And the winning bid for my book was by one Montese Crandall. And I loved the name so much that the introduction to the book, in which Montese talks directly to the audience, was born just because of my enthusiasm about the name.
Yeah, it is. It is a great name. Are you at liberty to say how much Montese paid to become the protagonist?
I never asked. Name? I'm sure it was a bargain. $59.95, probably.
It fits, though. I mean, it's fascinating that you can have something like that actually fit in the story. Talking Chimps.
You know, I read this late Michael Crichton book that's about stem cell research and cloning. And there's a moment in this, I can't remember the book now. Your listeners will probably all shower me with hate mail that I can't remember the title. But it has an orangutan, I believe, that acquires the gift of speech at the end. And I thought it was comical and that I might extend the idea and amplify it some.
Which you did, quite commendably so. Also, this whole idea of traveling to Mars, Mary Roach was recently on, and she was written a book called Packing to Mars. You just find yourself, I mean, she actually went and did all the NASA stuff and found out, you know, how you use a toilet when you have no gravity and so forth. Did you do a lot of research in that realm?
I did. I actually read up a fair amount. I went to the Air and Space Museum in Washington and bought $300 worth of books at one point and took them home and studied hard, because I only have cocktail party science, so I needed help.
You're not a science geek like Mary then, huh?
No, not at all.
But I still watch sci-fi movies? Are you still a sci-fi movie or horror movie geek?
Not as much. I think the contemporary horror film lacks for the sense of character and the innocence that the Cold War era horror films featured.
Talking again with Rick Moody, his new book, The Four Fingers of Death. You also take on, as I say, serious topics here. One of them is writer's block. You've wrestled with? Any wisdom to cast on that? We did a whole hour on it, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Who did you have?
We had some local psychoanalytic people who've written about it and who have explored it and so forth. But you, it's funny, you haven't grappled with it.
I haven't really. I mean, I think the 730 pages that we have before us indicates that recently I've had no problems.
Well, not only recently, but you've had a pretty prolific career and I mean, have moved into so many different genres. This is almost like a different genre. I mean, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I like to I like range, I think, is what I'm interested in the end.
Well, we have that in common, too. What I also found myself thinking about was, well, a couple things. I mean, there's so many things that this book raised in my own consciousness, but I had read Boys many years ago, which I know many of my listeners have probably read, and was very moved by it. And there was references in the piece to a sister who died, and I only learned recently that you had a sister who died also. And so your fiction does bring in at least some of your fiction, but this is so far afield from anything autobiographical. And when you wrote The Black Veil, you were dealing with your own life and you were writing from that personal and autobiographical place, highly dramatically different than writing, say, something like this.
I just used up the material is the truth. The Black Veil was such a demanding book to write. And the sort of publication and book tour part of that project, in which I had to go out into the field and talk about clinical depression and grief and all that kind of stuff, that was 3 or 4 months of my life that I would gladly not have to go through again. You know, it was extremely demanding. And when I was done with it, my fervent wish was to use my imagination. And so the next 3 books, all to one degree or another, were very imaginative, somewhat fanciful works.
Black Veil also, of course, the title is from Hawthorne, and your own New England background seems to have some of that Calvinistic Hawthorne feeling to it.
Well, indeed.
That you bring into your work, yeah?
Yeah, there was a Moody, Joseph Handkerchief Moody, he was called, who did, in fact, wear a veil. He was a parson in old Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 18th century, and he wore a veil just like the minister in the Hawthorne story of the same title.
Of course, there's also a perfect lobster roll recipe in that book, too.
Yeah, I think a lot about the lobster
roll. Sadness and depressing. People would probably like to know that recipe, if you could.
Well, don't put mustard in and no paprika. It really should just be the lobster and the mayonnaise and maybe a little salt and pepper in a lightly toasted hot dog roll.
Perfect. I mean, as good as it gets in terms of lobster rolls, right? Did you cut the last sentence out of this book?
I did not. You're not the first person to ask. I memorably have told people to cut the last sentence in almost all cases. But sometimes you get a good last sentence right at the beginning when you're working on something and you want to hang on to it.
Yeah, I know that feeling. And it's a great feeling, actually. You have taught creative writing and you have mentioned that you... Well, perhaps the best way to phrase this is you're somewhat skeptical about the whole enterprise?
I'm skeptical about the workshop. I'm skeptical about the writing workshop, which I think is sort of a focus group in the same way that a test screening is for a contemporary film. And I just feel like that leads us in the direction of catering to the demographic mean with short stories and novels. And I don't think that's where we want our literature to be. I think it should be more original than just what the middle of the demographic can talk about. So I think writing workshops do as much harm as they do good.
Well, you try to sort of resurrect the novel form here, don't you? I mean, that sounds pretty ambitious when I phrase it that way, but I think that's what you're up to, isn't it?
Perhaps. I'm not sure it's in dire circumstances to begin with. I mean, I think the form's pretty vital and that there are a lot of great novels being written these days. But I like the modernist idea that we can rehabilitate the form and rethink the form and make it do things it hasn't done before.
Well, part of that is just this wide canvas and putting on all kinds of things. It's sort of like a little Jackson Pollock or something, huh?
Yeah.
whatever moves you or whatever your impulse is, you know?
Well, I think fiction's gotten shorter and it's gotten sketchier, and you see that especially in the popularity of the short story these days. But I like to move in the other direction, one that requires more patience and sort of more ambition to make it in the first place.
Well, you're one of those novelists who also writes short fiction, and becoming less of a live breed, those who are capacious enough in their being able to move from genre to genre the way you do. What makes you sort of move to write short fiction as opposed to writing a novel? I mean, is there anything that you can catalog along those lines?
I like sort of the way that Nabokov thought about this, which is to say that he used the stories experimentally to sort of sketch out certain ideas for how to proceed with longer works, and often to try to think against whatever direction he was currently engaged. And short fiction works that way for me. It's a place where I can try things that I can't necessarily do in longer work.
Some would say maybe there's a danger in that because you're breaking away from conventions and trying to be innovative and inventive.
I never feel that it's dangerous.
Or it never keeps you back. It never inhibits you, no. Which is all to the good. You had some experiences, which kind of interested me, that you've written about in the publishing world back in when you were in your 20s and 30s, and you said that you learned so much about writers in the business that it made you sick. And in fact, you spent some time here in San Francisco.
I was here in San Francisco, yeah, in 83 and 84.
Why did it make you sick?
I still feel this way to some extent, that I don't really need to know or want to know about the means of production and about the writer's life and so on. I'm interested in the work. I actually find that insofar as the work gets bogged down with extraneous information, I'm less able to sort of fully enter into it. And some of the business of publishing afflicts me in that way.
Keep the life and the work separate.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much the way a lot of literary criticism viewed, I mean, going all the way back to T.S. Eliot and so forth,
yeah.
how it ought to operate. But there's been a shift. I mean, one is kind of cultural, the desire that you want to see writers in the work and figure where does this intersect with life and so forth. I mean, even I alluded to your sister's loss of life. I mean, we tend to do this sometimes by almost habit. But also it's becoming more sort of psychobiographical with novels, critics are.
I agree, and I think that's happening in the culture as a whole. I mean, I think that's sort of what the kind of reality television moment that we're living in prizes. But
You see it as unfortunate, though.
I see it as a little bit unfortunate. I mean, I like hearing the voice of a writer. I like going to a reading and hearing an Alice Munro or a Grace Paley read her work, and then when I go back to the page, I can hear her voice in the sentences a little bit. But I don't really need to know everything that happened to Grace Paley. I mean, the work is its own system, and I think it depends on our being able to enter into it freely and project ourselves onto it a little bit. And the biographical material might occlude that.
Although I must confess, for example, in reading your latest novel, I thought, this is a man who loves the desert and who really wants us to feel the desert.
Well, that's true. I've been spending more time there.
And particularly the Sonoran Desert, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was in Tucson a lot writing this book, and I grew to really love it.
The book takes us really on a kind of, rocket ship ride. I mean, it takes us for, in some ways, you're really working as an entertainer here, aren't you?
Well, the original Crawling Hand has a moonshot in it, but it's sort of implied. It's off stage a little bit. But when I decided that I wanted to work with the material, a moonshot would no longer have been adequate. And I immediately decided that the Mars mission was such a sort of counterproductive thing to attempt to do that I was immediately drawn to it. I mean, it seems impossible to try to imagine it if you come out of a realistic literary background.
Plus the moon thing has been – you ever read Mailer's book on The Fire of the Moon?
Yeah. I
mean, he's kind of done it.
Yeah.
You know, he did
yeah.
it and did so well with it. You going to go back to realism after this? Or?
Yeah, I am actually. I have a sort of hard turn in mind for the next novel.
I won't ask you what that's about, nor would I expect you to tell me. You also talked a lot lately – again, I want to go back to the work because I know that's what you're here to talk about. But you've talked a lot lately about becoming a father and about how important music is in your life, and it continues to play a central role. But being a father can hamper an artist's ambitions or, for that matter, work schedule.
It's certainly hampering my work schedule so far. That's the truth. It is. But I wouldn't trade it for anything, you know. And I think it's made me think in new ways about themes and about what's important to me as a writer. So it's sort of been a revolution in what I'm imagining I'm going to do from now on. And this hard turn that I'm speaking of with respect to what I'm doing next is largely because that experience has been so dramatic in my life, the parenting experience, that I want to get closer to the kinds of feelings that I've had in doing that.
Does it mean you have to sacrifice something?
I am sacrificing something. I mean
another part of your art, let's say.
Yeah. No, I am. And I think that that's probably what happens to writers when they do this, and especially when you're my age, which is to say almost 50, and dealing with a very young child.
She's what, 18 months now?
18
Hazel,
months.
Hazel is your daughter.
Hazel, yeah. I think it changes you dramatically. I'm sure it's true for everyone. But having been a writer for pretty much 20 years and kind of gotten into a rhythm with that, I'm now finding that I have to rethink the enterprise from the ground up. And I think the work's going to reflect that.
Are you still working in music, still performing in music?
Yep. The band's playing a couple times this fall, and we're about to get ready on recording the third album.
How have the other two done?
I think they sell extremely modestly, but that doesn't bother me.
But you're learning new instruments, too.
I mean,
you're learning child rearing as well as new instruments?
Yeah, and violin I took up in my 40s, although, boy, that's that difficult, very difficult.
So you really got a trilogy here in this new novel. Like I said, it's three in one.
Did you
map it out?
Novel.
Did you blueprint it?
No, I never do that. I just go where
it flows.
Yeah.
And you wanted to kind of bring us into, I mean, the sense I had reading it was you wanted, perhaps more than anything else, that's what you were maybe even a little joking, tongue in cheek, about this coming out of the ice storm, but bring us into this world of the joy of these kind of sci-fi movies and books that you got such great pleasure out of.
Yeah, it's an homage in that way to the kinds of narratives that I loved as a kid. And I think every writer has to do that at some point. I was thinking a little bit of Thomas Pynchon's love of adventure novels that so undergirds Mason and Dixon. I mean, that's really a novel about adventure stories for boys in some ways.
Well, this is an adventure story.
Yeah.
It really is. And it's a... It's kind of a later buildings roman in some ways for Montrese, in terms of coming into greater understanding. So you have that thread as well, that trajectory.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hard thing to do to try to repeat that 19th century novel experience. And I sort of thought I could maybe do it once in my life, and perhaps I've done it this time.
You see this as a motion picture?
I always think my work's unfilmable. I even thought The Ice Storm was unfilmable, so I'm probably not the right person. But it does seem as though, you know, 18 different points of view, gigantic cast of main characters, it would take a very creative director.
Hollywood could do it, but what they can do with it, that's the question.
Yeah,
I mean,
indeed.
They can corrupt it, of course. Were you happy with Ice Storm?
I love The Ice Storm.
The film,
yeah.
By Ang Lee.
Yeah.
I'm going to open up the phone lines, invite our listeners to join us with Rick Moody. Rick Moody readers, or if you saw the film The Ice Storm, or... if you read any of his novels, his memoir, The Black Veil, you want to talk about the novel we're talking about, which means talking about science fiction, really, and talking about those horrific horror movies that you saw perhaps as a kid, feel free to join the conversation. We welcome your calls. You can join us now toll-free, 866-733-6786, and that'll work whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join the program, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Rick Moody. His new book is called The Four Fingers of Death, and you are welcome to join the program. In fact, our lines are open to you if you are a Rick Moody reader, if you simply want to join the conversation and hit on with us any questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. I mentioned, by the way, that one of Rick Moody's novels is Garden State. That's not to be confused with the Zach Braff film. That happens a lot, I guess, doesn't it, because of the title?
It does. It's a pretty common title. There's actually another novel that had that as its title from the early 70s, so even I may have filched the title.
Is there a danger in writing a novel like this? Your canvas is so wide that it can become diffuse and it can kind of take you over?
I suppose other writers would feel that way, but because I really love that sort of classic mid-70s novel of enormity, like Gravity's Rainbow or J.R. or The Recognitions or The Executioner's Song, I'm not worried about diffuse. I think the nation in which the work is produced is diffuse, and it's therefore accurate in its representation.
And you said J.R. and made me think of Colonel Jed Richards. Where does he come from?
Where does Colonel Jed Richards come from? I think, you know, one thing that's of interest to me in this book is that Montes Crandall, the guy who's theoretically writing the book, the fictional character, throws up reiterations of himself again and again. And as the novel wears on, I think they sort of acquire pathos by virtue of their sheer number and diversity. And Jed Richards is the first time in the book that we have a character, from my point of view, who's an exact replica of Montes Crandall.
Well, we used to call a mirror image or a doppelganger or an identity fragment or all of the above in some ways. Did you become Crandall? Do you become that voice? Does he take you over in any way?
No, actually, I become the talking chimpanzee.
Literally.
Yes.
Well, maybe we can get you to read a little bit, speaking about talking chimpanzees.
Okay. This is a little passage in Montes's voice from the introduction. Perhaps you're wondering what I have done to merit such a high opinion of my legacy. What's the nature of the Montes Crandall literary innovation? I'm going to take the remainder of this brief introduction to explicate fully my response to this question. Let me then throw down the gauntlet and remark that I, Montes Crandall, MFA, write very, very short, very condensed literary pieces, and by short, I mean very, very short. Shorter than you've probably read in your reading life, more than one word usually, because one word is too easy, but quite a bit more modest than 50. The 350 pages of a novel, according to the argument I am wont to advance, are tedious elaboration. As I understand it, death, war, and adultery are the major novelistic themes, and these were all dispensed with well before Christ got nailed to his block of wood. The 19th century novel, you opine? The 19th century novel does have it all. Attic-dwelling harridans, uncanny coincidences, advantageous marriages to strong, silent landowners, orphans, revolutions, wailing. You can't go wrong with the 19th century novel, but much that has been written since amounts to imitation, barely warmed over by writers with strange grammatical inclinations. Lovelorn women of Canada, incest on the southern plantation, drug-using editorial assistants, the usual stuff. Yours truly, Montes Crandall, living out his Pacific middle age in a college town next door over to nowhere at all, is unwilling to add more roughage to this diet. One thing the late 20th century was good at, besides mass marketing, paring away, omitting needless words, alluding without overstating, dust bunny under radiator, cockroach on window blind, scotch bottles, heartbreak in the food court, impotent subdivisions, melanoma, muffler problems. Upon the advent of the digital age, as you know, writers who went on and on just didn't last. You couldn't read all that nonsense on a screen.
Well, you're a good ventriloquist, obviously, but there's a kind of shtick quality to that, too. The irony comes through in the way you read it and his pretentiousness and his... Well, pontificating really is what it is. Well caught and well realized. Talk about talking chimps, huh? Here's a listener, David, who writes, I was a dorm master when Rick was a student at a boarding school in New England. Plenty of his peers made my life pretty difficult, but Rick was not one of them, at least not that I can recall. It's been fun watching your writing career develop over the years since you and I left New Hampshire. No doubt what happened during those formative years is one of the filters through which you write. I wish you all the best and continued success.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Listener named David. By the way, speaking about your formative years, you studied with Russell Banks.
I did, at Columbia when I got my MFA, yeah.
And you're 24 years old. You didn't necessarily know that Eudora Wilty was a writer that you can now in your early 50s appreciate.
That's one of the great things, right, about how taste changes over time. You're unready for certain things at certain ages, and then later you really get them.
Yeah, and even the things that you may be slightly ready for and love at a certain age, you can have a totally different experience with and love for different reasons at a different age.
Yeah.
Here's Kate, a listener, says, did I just hear your guest say that Vonnegut's Sirens of Titan was the big one? Just had to say that it's hands down my favorite Vonnegut novel by all measures. And another listener says, perhaps mention Albertine Notes.
Albertine,
Notes, great novella in Moody's catalog or Moody's canon or...
Yeah, that was sort of the dry run for trying to work out a science fiction approach. I wrote this novella.
What was it? I'm not familiar with it.
It was in the book before this. I published a book of novellas called Right Livelihoods. And that story, Albertine Notes, is in that book. And it has a very Philip K. Dick aspect to it. And it was an attempt to try to think along these lines.
Futuristic also?
Yeah, it's futuristic.
Do you ever have, and growing up, because, you know, you've been through depression and all that, what about the name Moody? I mean, do people ever make fun, ridicule, call attention? How's the response been to that through your years?
Oh, you're just bringing back those elementary school hijinks.
Sorry, don't
right
mean
now,
to necessarily
Mike.
Do that. No trauma and memories intended here. But, you know, here you are, a New Englander, and, you know, going through some trials and tribulations, and the name Moody almost seems like a character in a story.
Yeah, as though one is cursed with one's name a little bit. Although I think the original word, if I remember the sort of philology of it, means courageous. So back before it meant bipolar disorder, it may have meant courageous.
It's a much better spin on it. Yeah. It's very well done. Here's Jeff who says, what's the difference about the honesty in your writing a memoir as opposed to an autobiographical novel?
That's a really good question. I actually sort of hew to the Susan Sontag idea that I'm never more fictional than in my nonfiction and never more honest than in my fiction. And I think fiction's screen allows us to tell truths that we can't really tell in nonfiction. I try to be perfectly honest, and there's no, hyperbole or exaggeration in my memoir whatsoever. It all happened as I remember it. But I will say that
memory can play tricks too.
Oh, certainly. And also the form I found rigid in certain ways. I mean, I found it hard to work with. It's easier for me to tell a certain kind of emotional truth about myself through the veil of characters in a novel than it was to just try to confront it head on.
That's interesting. So the memoir turns to be kind of a shackling form in some ways.
That's how I experienced it, yeah.
You going to write any more memoir?
No way.
That was it. That was a tough experience writing it, huh?
Yeah. I mean, maybe when I'm 75, I'll write my literary story or something, but I found in the end that I'm not a great memoirist in some ways. I feel more free and more at liberty in the area of fiction than I do in nonfiction.
On the other hand, you've become so, in love with being a father. That may figure in autobiographical or memoir writing in the future.
Indeed.
Have you read many of those books? There are a lot of them around here now. Michael Lewis, Michael Chabon, just locally, wanting to at least communicate what it means to be a father and bring up children.
I like Michael Chabon's book. He's a writer I like enormously, actually. I sort of want to go wherever he wants to go. And I thought that book was really heartfelt and moving.
Does that mean you want to go where he wants to go in fiction, too?
I don't think I can. I think he's a one of a kind.
But he's also moved into some very imaginative and fantasia realms, as you have in this new novel.
he just has great, in my way of thinking, great storytelling chops. I mean, he's a beautiful line-by-line writer, but he's a great, great storyteller. And I don't think there's anyone else really like him working in that way right now.
It's also a lot of Michael's gifts have to do with stylistics and just the way he uses language.
Yeah, I mean, beautiful line-by-line.
Who else do you read now that you really are drawn to? You mentioned Alice Munro before. Who else?
I love Don DeLillo. I think as a stylist, he's at the very top of the list. I love Lydia Davis quite a bit. I mean, she's a writer I've really sat down and sort of looked at very closely for the way she uses rhythm and variations of line lengths and so forth. They're probably among my favorites of contemporary American writers.
One hears, I was mentioning stylistics, one hears about you something that I've been either blessed or afflicted by through the years, and that is the extent of your vocabulary. A number of critics have commented on this, using – it's sort of like T.C. Boyle. You know, there are words in there that send people running the dictionary. That comes from your reading. It comes from your, obviously, education and so forth. But like the sound, obviously, of certain words, don't you?
I do. I mean, I like that in other writers. If I'm reading a book and there's a word that I'm not familiar with that sounds great to me, I'm delighted by that. And I hope that some readers feel similarly, that it's not that they're meant to feel belittled by a sort of fancy turn of phrase, but rather encouraged to delight in English doing what English can do.
Are you fluent in other languages?
No, I have meager amounts of French and a sort of smattering of Italian, and that's about it.
But you do love the English language, and it's probably one of the reasons why you're drawn to writers like DeLillo and Nabokov and Chabon, because they all are great lovers of the English language.
Yeah.
And Eudora Welty. I mean, what one gets in her work is not even so much the English language as a whole culture of the South and the Mississippi Delta and all of that.
Yeah, and O'Connor, too. I mean, that perfectly deployed dialect in O'Connor is so beautiful to read on the page.
You love the cadence and rhythm of language. I mean, you can see it in this new novel, but you've never written poetry, really, have you?
No, I'm not a poet, alas.
There are a lot of novelists who would have liked to have been poets. You're not one of those, are you?
No.
Another listener, Kristen, writes, I wanted to thank Rick Moody for his writing. I very much enjoy and admire his ability to put thoughts into words. I sometimes find reading to be a sort of therapy with a reverse process from regular therapy. When reading, the therapist does the talking and the patient listens. Mr. Moody very articulately named the importance of a reader's not knowing too much about an author's life, instead being free to project into the material his own meaning. So true. Just as it is in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, which is my profession. That's from a listener named Kristen. Here's a listener named Rick who says, wow, this guy should be the voice of his books on tapes, just from listening to your reading. A lot of your books are on tapes, right?
No, in fact, The Ice Storm and Four Fingers are the only two books that there are audio versions of.
I'm surprised. Why?
I don't know. It's never happened, and no one's ever asked me to do it. Not that I want to put in the 3 weeks necessarily. I mean, it seems like it'd be a lot of work to do your own audio text. But now it's happening, and I'm happy for that.
When you were writing this book, were you Dickens used to actually talk like you just talked in the character's voice when you were reading that. Were you doing that in the writing too?
No, it happens in my head, really. I mean, I read out loud eventually because I think you eliminate mistakes by reading the prose aloud. But unlike James, who actually dictated especially those late novels, I always worry that then it's too colloquial sounding. So this is work that has to be on the page before it gets read aloud, and it has to have a literary look on the page to me. That's important.
That email I read was talking about the psychological or psychodynamic effect of your writing, and you just mentioned James, and there's an old quip about the two James brothers, you know, that William James was the psychologist who wrote like a novelist, and Henry was the novelist who wrote like a psychologist, and sometimes you write like a psychologist.
I love William James. In fact, of the James brothers, he's my preference. Yeah, I like earlier James, but I'm defeated by the Golden Bull, which I'm sorry I'm saying this on the radio. It's okay. Embarrassing. But
a lot of people find James as a novelist formidable, difficult, vexing, all of the above. Yeah.
But I think William James is a beautiful, supple, brilliant writer. I think Varieties of Religious Experience is an amazing book.
I agree with you. But some of Henry James's short stories, in addition to a novel like The Ambassadors or The Wings of a Dove, are great literature.
No, I like that one called The Aspern Papers. Do you remember that one?
Of course.
Sort of a literary comedy. Love that story.
And The Princess Casamassima. I mean, there's a lot of James that people – that's a little bit obscure to people who even are somewhat familiar with him.
Yeah.
And Aspern Papers is a good example of that. Most people know him for The Turn of the Screw, of course, and that's just such a very different kind of work for him, just like this is for you.
Yeah.
Proud of this work, though, huh?
I like it. I always like whatever the most recent thing is. I mean, my idea of torture is to have to sit around and talk about the ice storm.
Which you have done ad nauseum.
Yeah, I have. Once there's a movie, you have to talk about it for a while.
Well, yeah, and you had nothing to do really with that movie, did you?
No, I got to visit the set, which was thoroughly enjoyable, but I was also glad to leave the set.
You get to talk to Sigourney Weaver or any of that kind of star contact? Or?
I did then, yeah.
What's she like?
She's quite brilliant, very well read, and her husband's a sort of a, I hate to say this because I don't even believe in the phrase, but kind of an avant-garde theater director. So they're very well informed, brilliant, engaged with the arts type people, and it's really fun to spend a half an hour with them talking about what they're reading and interested in.
I mentioned the keys. Because there are certain images that stand out in novels and in films and remain in one's consciousness. And that whole thing about swapping and so forth was it made me think of Updike, of course. I don't know if in writing the novel if or even to a lesser extent Cheever. I mean, those worlds of New England and the bourgeois life and the sort of looking for thrills and infidelity and or not even looking for thrills, just trying to break through the numbness of that sort of life, they're influences too, aren't they?
Michael, are you trying to get me to talk about this because I just said that the ice storm was like torture to me?
The film you were talking about. I'm talking about the novel.
I actually thought of the ice storm as the—
And I'm talking literary. I'm trying to get you on Updike and Cheever, really.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought of the book when I was writing it as the revenge of Rabbit Angstrom's children. I mean, that was foremost in my mind, that the rabbit books— wrote about parenting in the 60s and 70s as though the children were of no consequence at all. I mean, those books were cruel to the children. Rabbit Angstrom was cruel to his children. And I thought that the children needed a chance to speak up.
Except if Rabbit had found his daughter, I think he would have been very tender and loving. He was a man hungry for a daughter. He was talking about Updike's Quartet, of course, the Rabbit novels here. Yeah, I really like that idea, though, of Rabbit's children. Sorry if it was torture. Let's go to some calls here. And Mitchell from San Francisco is our caller. Hi.
My question, actually, it's a wonderful show, by the way, is what did your MFA program do for you as a writer? Is getting a master's something that was important to you as a developing writer? And I would love to teach. What did you get out of being taught? Just that whole idea.
I don't think I got that much out of being taught in my MFA program that I didn't also get out of my Bachelor of Arts program. And that was sort of part of my problem with it. I think the value of an MFA program for me was partly in the sense of community. I went to Columbia, which has a pretty large enrollment. I think there were 60 or 70 writers in that program. So there was a real sense of community to the place. And the other part of it that was useful was just being out of the workforce for 2 years, pretty much, and thus having time to concentrate on my work. The actual classes, I don't think, schooled me in how to teach a writing class. That I had to learn on my feet from doing it a little bit myself.
Did you in print in The Atlantic criticize this program at Columbia?
I criticized the writing workshop in general, but I used Columbia as an example since I knew quite a bit about it, obviously.
But you were talking about the Banks course as if it was really important in your formative development.
That was a literature class.
It was not a creative writing class.
No.
Right? Well, I mean, it's It's interesting because when you do study literature, I tell students that you learn a lot more about the craft sometimes than you do in creative writing classes, where one of the problems being that you're criticizing each other's work instead of reading the masters and studying them.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no replacement for attending closely to the masters. And that was how writers always used to do it before there were writing workshops. And oftentimes you'll encounter kids in writing workshops now who aren't reading with the same violent enthusiasm that I think they ought to be if they want to take the job seriously.
So notice, because young people will bring me sometimes creative work too strongly influenced by television now. I mean, that really is a problem. Now, in your case, it worked out well with the horror movies and creature features and so forth. I mean, it helped give birth to this novel. But so much of the dialogue and so much of really the plotting seems just drawn from a lot of the schlock on television.
Huh. That's interesting. I haven't encountered that as much as I've encountered sort of a relentless minimalist realist influence. To me, it's still Richard Ford and Raymond Carver sort of hovering just out of the frame a lot of the time.
But you know, Carver hated being called a minimalist. He didn't buy that at all. It was largely because of Gordon Lish, his editor, who just cut everything.
Yeah.
Do you work with an editor, and how closely do you work with an editor?
Well, it's a commonplace that editing is less a part of the process than it used to be in publishing these days. I like to find a receptive acquaintance at a certain stage in a project and invite him or her to do their worst.
In terms of just
chopping
apart. Yeah.
And that's the part that really helps me.
So you have some... It's funny you call them receptive acquaintances as opposed to being a receptive friend.
Exactly opposed to being a receptive friend.
Because they can be too colored by their friendship.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So how much did that go into this book, that receptive acquaintance influence?
Cut almost 100 pages in the second draft. So I cut quite a bit. Believe it or not, it was over 900 pages at one point.
Wow. Talking again with Rick Moody, his new novel is The Four Fingers of Death. And by the way, he is going to be appearing here in the Bay Area. You're going to be at a couple of bookstores. Let's just mention that now.
Kepler's tonight in Menlo Park at 7 o'clock, I believe, and Books, Inc. in Berkeley tomorrow night, also 7 o'clock.
You mentioned Brodigan earlier on, and I can see the influence in this book of Brodigan. Also, maybe even to some extent, Tom Robbins. You know, they were, again, probably novelists who had an influence on you during your period of absorbing novelists and forming your own voice. Can you form a voice? No. Finding your own voice. Those writers have kind of fallen off the literary stock exchange. Something to despair in that, maybe. If so is Vonnegut, really, to a great extent.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this. The book's obviously dedicated to Kurt Vonnegut, and I didn't know him personally at all, although I know his widow, Jill Kremetz, the great photographer, a little bit. And I don't understand what happened exactly, except that Kurt was less productive later in his life and times have moved in a slightly different direction. But I think...
one of the last interviews with him, and he said, "I'm tired." And he made it very clear that he was tired of writing.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, they've sort of gone, their currency has gone down.
Yeah, but I think these things are sort of cyclical. I mean, I think Vonnegut is unimpeachably important and historically important. And that there was more creative thinking about form in his work than we give him credit for. I mean, we all know that he loved the simple sentence and that a certain abbreviated prose style really sounds like Vonnegut to us, but Slaughterhouse-Five is really cleverly structured. It's intriguingly structured, and that's true of a lot of those books. Breakfast of Champions, which I really liked, is a very strange book. It's experimental in its way. And
what about Cat's Cradle, which is also in some ways really experimental?
Yeah.
And pretty apocalyptic.
Yeah, very apocalyptic. So I think those works are important and that they will continue to be at some point. Brodigan and Robbins, separate questions, because Brodigan especially is so ineluctably bound up with the time of his most popular works that he wasn't around to kind of keep making work after that. I just read his last novel So the Dust Will Blow It Away. I think that's right.
Yeah.
Which was published.
And his daughter's still writing novels.
She's writing. Yeah. That book was published in the late 70s, almost 1980, I think. So at a very different time from the sort of loosey-goosey trout fishing in America period. And it's a beautiful, sad book, I think. Very clever and movingly written.
Well, in your new novel, you have a love affair, too.
I do.
And there's a tenderness and a kind of poignancy to that. You wanted that there, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I think comedy and melancholy are directly adjacent to one another, and that the one shades into the other. So I think Montese Crandall, who's writing this book at a moment of grief in his own life, is a comic writer, but is also in a condition of longing for affiliation and family and familial rewards, and that undergirds the whole. So a love affair is natural in a book like that.
Just needed to find a group to perform music with, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He needed to get out of the house.
Rick Moody, pleasure having you on here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
And The Four Fingers of Death is out and available. And again, you can meet Rick Moody this evening at Kepler's. He'll be there at 7 o'clock in Books, Inc. in Berkeley tomorrow night. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And I want to remind you, you can always let us know what you think about Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org or calling our listener call-in response line, which is 415-553-3300. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our interns are Nadia Reed, Elena Cadavani, and Aiden Stone. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of today's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.